Welcome to the Popcorn Talk Network, for the online broadcast network that features movie discussion, news, and interviews. Press one.
Popcorn Talk. We talk movies.
I'm opening.
We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
Welcome, Anatomy of Movie fans, here on the Popcorn Talk Network. We are not doing Knight Rider, we are doing Ted 2. We could have picked any number of songs and it would have fit.
Absolutely.
We have Dimitri Panos on board with us today. I'm your host, Phil Svitek. And as mentioned, we are doing Ted 2, the follow-up to Ted, the original.
Ted, the original, yeah. Yeah, we're putting him on the slab. And is he full of too much stuffing?
That's right. We'll find out. If this is your first time with us, welcome. If you're a returning customer, so to speak, welcome back. Please rate, subscribe, comment. We do this every week. We do it for free to you guys, and that's all we ask for in return, because it just helps make the show better.
Yeah, and especially now with Ted, with so many references, we're going to get into references. But they were flying so fast, heavy and furious in this movie. There's a bunch that I missed. So folks, if you're watching, you've seen Ted 2, compare your list with my list. I want to learn what I missed, because there's so many of them.
That's right. I will preface this with a couple things, right? We always start with general remarks and overall impressions. I am a South Park guy more than a Family Guy. So if there are bias against the movie, it's because of that. Dimitri has, not that he's a big Family Guy. He likes this type of humor. He speaks highly of Seth MacFarlane. I'm going to give him a chance to really speak about Seth MacFarlane in a couple moments. But for me,
he doesn't owe me money, so right off the top, he's okay with me.
What I will say about Seth, I really loved A Million Ways to Die in the West, and I'm still curious as to this day why people didn't like it as much.
Do you believe it's been about a year? It was about a year ago this time you and I talked about A Million Ways to Die in the West, and we were both really big fans. I believe we both agreed that it was a very underrated comedy, and we couldn't believe why it was getting such the skewering, because it's a funny movie.
It absolutely is, so definitely check that. Check out the movie, check out us doing that movie, and it seems at this point that Seth MacFarlane is doing about a movie a year-ish.
Yeah, as many he can, yeah. Yeah, with his busy schedule.
But A Million Ways to Die in the West, what I enjoyed about it was that the jokes were on par with the plot.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, there was a plot. There was, we took the plot and we kind of ran with it in various different ways.
Sure.
And then we had a lot of jokes that didn't service the plot. They were just, slowing down the plot, so to say. And one of the things that we will talk about, and many people agree. There's a great quote that I actually want to I share these views. James Berardinelli of Real Views gave the film 2 out of 4 stars, saying it would be disingenuous for me to claim that Ted 2 isn't funny. Although I was often bored by the plotting direction of the story, I laughed from time to time.
Sure,
I laughed more of the time, so yeah. I will admit that. But I will say, I want you guys to know, as we talk about these jokes, I'm 100% going to agree that they are funny.
Right,
but I think it suffered a little bit. But I certainly don't want to make this a bash fest, so I'm going to be more fact-based, and so that's fresh cakes. That means the floor is yours, Dimitri.
My quick thoughts. Look, for me, it was geek-tastically hilarious sequel to the original. I thought it was as good as. Maybe not better, but definitely as good as, on par. What I'm going to say regarding Seth MacFarlane is, I am a fan. I don't I don't watch Family Guy with any regularity. However, what I do watch, I always enjoy. I like his type of humor. I really did love Ted, as we talked about, Million Ways to Die in the West and Ted 2. I find, you know, and plus he's got a great singing voice. I mean, who else picked up his Christmas album from this past year? It was one of the best. It was great. You know, so the guy does a lot. He's really busy. And I find him to be very on point with his humor, whether it's regarding his satire, his political incorrectness, which we should talk about a little bit later on, and his references. To me, and dare I say, I'll probably get some flack for this, but I don't want to be completely misunderstood here. I think today, as far as today goes, he is as close as we can get to a modern day type of Mel Brooks. Not as good as Mel Brooks. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying he at least attempts. He puts into this movie, into his television show, his comedy is irreverent, socially topical and satirical. He's very off color, which today, I mean, it is hard to make, to be not politically correct without getting some semblance of criticism, which he gets. And when you think back to like Blazing Saddles, Mel Brooks took his, you know, he took a lot of flack for being politically incorrect, even from the studio that released his movie. So, you know, any, you know, political correctness goes out the window, and there's a lot of pop culture referencing and throwbacking to, which really, you know, when you look at Mel Brooks's career, you know, Blazing Saddles was not only an homage to the Western, but it did poke fun of racism and those tropes. And then Young Frankenstein, obviously, we know, you know, that was about, you know, his love of the old horror movies. What are we going to do? And then High Anxieties was Alfred Hitchcock. So Seth MacFarlane, just today in today's pop culture world, you know the things that he's loved. Things like Star Wars and Star Trek. And he's able to reference these in a fantastic, wonderful way. I liken it to Mystery Science Theater 3000, the great television show that they purposely threw out references, including the kitchen sink, knowing that not all of them, like the masses, were going to get, maybe just one person, but they played to that one person as well. Seth MacFarlane in this, I find, is the same way, and I just found this movie to be hysterical. I laughed from beginning to end.
Hmm.
You know, and you and I had great conversation again, which I want to get deeper into, because I think we agreed that we liked the jokes.
We did, or most 100%. Of the jokes, right? I can agree with 100% certainty. You know, there isn't really a joke that whether you or you guys at home, you know, watching or listening, can tell me in the movie, and I'm going to agree, it's funny. And on
it
paper,
just got in way of a plot, or the plot got in the way of a joke.
Yeah, you know what I mean? If this was a stand-up special, I would agree 100%.
Gotcha.
You know, and there's something said to be brev. You know, one of the reasons why I actually do enjoy Family Guy a lot, or more than most South Park fans, you know, because I get that there's a bit, sort of a divide there. And one of the reasons why it works is that regardless of whatever it is that you're getting in a Family Guy episode, you know it's going to be 22 minutes.
Right.
So there's that containment right off the bat. Whereas with this was almost 2 hours. It was just a little bit too long. I will say my biggest bit, you know, and again, I'll stop bashing it
in
a moment. You know, but my biggest knock on it was a couple of things. Number one, the Donnie plot line. I didn't really think you needed it. It was just recycled from the first one. We had enough to work with getting Ted legalized. That you, what? Why?
It
was just something. It was a direction we didn't need.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that, you know, whether it was just a way to shoehorn in Giovanni Ribisi, who I like, and, you know, I have no problem with, but I agree. And I think had it been consolidated, you know, had you just made the villain the exec, you know, the president of Hasbro, which could have been easily done. I mean, the whole Ted trial was being televised, and him being the exec from Hasbro, who may have or may not have had the rights to Ted back in the day, if he said, wow, if this is going on, he could have come up with that idea on his own, and it could have been Evil Corporation was the villain. We didn't so much need, Donnie in this film. And I do think that it sort of kind of stretched this movie out unnecessarily.
So
I agree with you.
And it kind of ballooned into eventually, you know, the whole confrontation. As soon as, like, they're found out, he runs away saying, like, I work for Mattel! That is a funny line.
That was
line.
A funny line, yes, but, the Hasbro guy.
But it didn't, it just kind of windled out from there.
Yeah.
Because you could have been like, you know, you could have gotten the police involved, like, who, you know, what's going on here, stuff like that. Oh, I don't know, he said he was the Mattel guy.
Yeah. And it led to a hairpiece joke, which, yep. Again, you know, I always find that a movie like this that throws so much out there, not all of it works. Some of it doesn't work. And again, I'll go back to Mel Brooks. Not all of the jokes work, but they throw them in there because maybe somebody likes it or just because the writers liked it. You know, you throw as much as you can, and some of them you sort of kind of groan. There were a couple that I went, ugh. But for the most part, you know, I thought it was hysterical. But the hairpiece joke, again, it just seemed like it was superfluous at that point. That character was superfluous.
Yeah. The other thing that I felt strongly about was the fact of, you know, I like Ted overall.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did I love it as much as everybody else? Not necessarily, but I did love it enough. And the whole point of Ted, you have the perfect unison between Laurie, John, and Ted.
Right.
Right. You know, he can have his girlfriend, soon to be wife, and he can have his best friend.
Right.
We completely throw that out the window.
Right.
And the reason for that, Mila Kunis, you know, she was pregnant with Ashton Kutcher's baby.
Right.
Couldn't catch. But I feel like in lieu of that, like, figure out a way to write that in. You know what I mean?
That she was sleeping with Ashton Kutcher and she was having a baby.
I don't know anything.
Which could have been another reference.
Exactly. Anything. But just to, I don't know, I felt so strongly in that sense. I just, you know, I just like somewhat of a through line.
Right.
You know, and something that we'll talk, which is shocking to hear, but this is Mark Wahlberg's first sequel.
A sequel to his own movie.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, he was in Transformers 4 and such. He's been in sequels, but he came in late on the franchise. Yeah, I found this shocking to believe as well, that he's never done a sequel to his own movie.
Yeah, exactly. And so with that, you know... you know, I just found it like, why, what, you know, create that sort of through line, you know, and especially, like, we've seen Mark Wahlberg and Mila Kunis before, like, it would have been great.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't, again, it didn't, I understood that she couldn't do the movie, and you know, she probably had things, you know, and she not bear child, which is a very important and great thing, makes them very happy, and God bless them, but for whatever reason, she couldn't do the movie. They couldn't wait, you know. So to me, it didn't bother me the way that she was sort of kind of written out. Because it was, you know, if you watch the original Ted, John has the line where she was trying to turn me into something that I'm really not. And that was one of the things in Ted. However, being endearing, and I think it's a problem that you have with Ted, too. Because in Ted, John realizes that, you know, he can be a better man, and he doesn't that, and that he can share his time with the love of his life and his best friend, and, you know, and he can go and cavort and, you know, drink and do whatever, but he can be a better man. This movie didn't have any of that, like, how do I be a better man, so to speak, and that sort of kind of went out the window because they seem to have fallen back to what they used to do before to an extent.
Yeah.
You know. But we were talking about that.
Yeah, no, we were. So those were my, you know, biggest problems with it. But let's start kind of back. Even before Ted, we'll keep calling it Ted the original. You heard a great interview with Howard Stern and Seth MacFarlane that kind of, and it talks about Fox and Ted not being picked up on that.
Yeah, it's you know, one of those great Hollywood stories, and it was a really great smart question that MacFarlane, I think, answered to the best of his capabilities, tiptoed a little bit, but basically it was, you know, he's had such great success at Fox, you would have thought that Ted, which is a Universal movie, you would have thought that Fox, when he came to them and said, hey, I want to make this movie about a talking teddy bear, and you would have thought that with all the success that they had given, that he had given Fox, that they would have said yes. But they said no.
Yeah,
they passed on it.
And so to kind of explain to people, you know, usually when you're in that type of deal, Fox has a first right of refusal.
Right.
They get, you know, Seth MacFarlane brings them, you know, whatever project that he wants.
Yeah.
They yay or nay it, and then kind of move on from there. In this case, they nay it.
And the question was, like, why did Fox, like, say no to you? Like, you've brought them so much money. And, you know, and at the time, it was basically, they felt that it was going to be costly to make a very off-color comedy, which was going to be rated R for sure. There was no way he was going to tone it down to PG-13. So you're already, in today's world, they talk at pulling away some of the audience because you're not going to get the younger kids to go see this movie. It was going to cost north of $60+ million because of the CG work on Ted. And, Fox passed, and Universal, he took it to Universal, and they gave it a shot. They said, all right, you know, we're in. You got Mark Wahlberg in, and Universal at the time, you know, great relationship with Mark Wahlberg as well. And then the come around of the story is that Howard had said, yeah, but somebody at Fox got fired for this. And Seth MacFarlane tiptoed around this. He said, well, yeah, I think somebody lost their job. I don't really know who he was. You know, and he still has to play nicey nice too because he has a show on there. So, but it's one of those great Hollywood stories that Fox could have made. They could have made a boatload of money just off of, like, had they taken Ted on. Because I believe Universal, Ted the original made domestically $218 million. So, like, that's huge. And they lost, you know, that was $218 million that Fox didn't have at the box office that year. And so, yeah, of course, you know, in hindsight's 2020, but Universal made the pickup, and of course, when it came time to do a sequel, you know, they also allowed, I believe, A Million Ways to Die in the West was Universal as well, so they had faith in Seth, and they allowed him to make his Western. So, yeah, and then it comes back to, which wasn't received well at all, both critically and financially, and it's like, hey, okay, well, now you gotta give us Ted 2. So, he comes back with a sequel. So, you know.
Yeah.
But it's funny. I always love those stories about how Star Wars was supposed to be a Universal movie. Went to Fox. E.T., I think, was supposed to be a Fox movie, and they passed on E.T., which went to Universal.
Now we're just bashing Fox.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's just funny how it's Universal and Fox seem to swap popular properties with one another. So, it's interesting. But I always love those stories.
Yeah. Well, in terms of Ted 2... Specifically, during the 2012 American Dad Comic-Con panel, MacFarlane stated that he would be open to a sequel. Later in September, Chief Executive Steve Burke from Universal said that the studio would be looking to make a sequel ASAP.
Mm-hmm.
From there, in January 2013 on Anderson Live, Wahlberg confirmed that a sequel was in the works. And that MacFarlane would, of course, that him and MacFarlane would actually come out on stage at the 85th Academy Awards. And by the way, for those of you who remember, it was actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that a lot.
Yeah, yeah. It was Seth MacFarlane hosting. And, yeah, no, it was, he even talked about hosting the Academy Awards. And, you know, Howard said, oh, that must have really sucked for you. You know, would you do it again? He goes, if I was asked, I would do it again. He goes, you know, you go in there. And again, his whole philosophy is, I'm thinking about trying to entertain not just the people who are in front of me, but on TV as well. And I know some stuff isn't going to work, but, you know, he is a showman.
Yeah.
And I think that shows through with Seth MacFarlane whenever you see him in an interview or even in his movies and in his television show.
But I think I will give him a lot of credit, like doing the Academy Awards and, you know, when he's doing interviews and stuff like that. Yeah, he is a perfect showman, but that's a different type of stage.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And,
absolutely.
And he's honed his craft in that way. Obviously, you have to kind of do it live and in the moment.
Sure.
But there is preparation that goes into it.
Yeah.
And you have to know which marks to hit. with a movie, you know, with TV show, obviously, as I mentioned, he's got 22 minutes with a movie. I think he's got to just figure out the compress some stuff so that way you get all the jokes that you need, but still keeping it, whatever. I hate to say it doesn't have to be 90 minutes, but a little bit faster paced. Get through some of the stuff.
You know, I agree with you. And we've talked about this with comedies and a lot of comedies, including Ted, the original, and Ted 2. They suffer from not being edited down a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, when you look at some of the great comedies, they're rarely over 100 minutes. You know, rarely do I think a comedy, with the exception of It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, need be that much over 90 minutes. Unless you have the goods and there's not a lot of superfluous stuff that's dragging things down. But, it just seems to be, and I think maybe, I don't want to slam the guy, but maybe Judd Apatow had started this whole thing with comedies being 2 hours and 10 minutes, 2 hours and 20. It's like, they don't have to be.
You can, Judd Apatow, don't get me started on that. Take everyone, they need to be edited down so
absolutely
much.
Absolutely. And we talk, you know, talking about Ted 2, there are things that could have been edited out. Maybe made it just tighter, more compact. And then that way, I always feel that don't give an audience time to breathe. Like, if you're going to make this kind of a comedy, and that was the great thing about Mel Brooks, is rarely did he give an audience time to breathe. It was joke, 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 joke. Not all of them worked, but man, it was always out there. There was something going on. And, you know, and I think a lot can be learned from watching the Mel Brooks comedies, from watching comedies like Airplane, or even like an Animal House kind of a thing. You know, just take it in what these comedies are all about. Maybe edit, edit, edit. And we talk about that a lot on this show, especially for some comedies.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
So, and again, going into the sequel, though, he purposely did not want to make, and he goes, I didn't want to make the same movie. And I don't think, with the exception of Donnie, right, because that sort of kind of was the same movie, you know, he did take it to a next step, and he made a different story. This wasn't about John, so to speak. The first movie, I think we can agree on, was about John, right, about his life being better and finding the love of his life, making him happy and living in the world of best friends and girlfriend. This one was really, in essence, a civil rights movie. This was, is Ted real or not? You know, and it's a classic science fiction trope, this kind of thing, whether it be Star Trek or Isaac Asimov, iRobot. It's like, can something that is not quote unquote human be human? And that's what he does with this movie. And he just made it. He made it a little bit bigger and different, and geektastic referential, I think. He threw in a hell of a lot more references in Ted 2 than there were in Ted.
You know? No, I agree. You know, what I really wanted Ted to... Comedy's tough because you can't really necessarily arc too many characters, right? But I did want Samuel L. Jackson, Morgan Freeman... Which I always thought odd, by the way, the fact that we reference Samuel L. Jackson as being the black man in every single movie.
Right.
And you don't have him in this movie, but you have Morgan Freeman.
Right.
I thought that,
that was
that
funny.
Just always gets me. But I thought it was interesting where Morgan Freeman's character says, you know, you haven't really, I'm not taking on your case because you haven't inspired anybody. You've wasted away your life. And yes, towards the end, he proves that he's inspired John. But can he go beyond that? Like, you know, I think in some ways, there's obviously a great irony that the movie came out on the day that, gay marriage was passed in Congress.
Yeah.
Or not, you know, through the Supreme Court and all that. But I don't mind satire. I love satire.
Sure.
But in some ways, again, if you're going to kind of compare his plight to gay marriage, you have to go completely about it in a stronger, I'm trying to pick the right words. And Ted doesn't arc, you know, and if you're someone kind of, whether it's African Americans, whether it's the gays, so on and so forth, I could see someone being really pissed off of like, you know what? Like, yeah, what have you actually done for society? Your plight is not like ours at all. And that was the joke. And it would have been fine if that was the joke. And then eventually he was like, oh, you're right. I'm not like these people. I gotta better society.
Yeah, you know, I think within the confines of Ted, too, and even Ted, you know, it's funny because while I was watching, it's like, geez, Ted, what have you done for people? And, you know, as an audience member, I was thinking to myself, Ted, you're making me laugh, but I'm an audience. I'm not a character in the movie. And the way he affected, well, his wife, you know, his wife who really loves him very much, even Amanda Seyfried as the lawyer that takes the case on as pro bono, she comes to learn that Ted has a lot to offer, just as being, you know, where he may not invent the next greatest thing that's going to change the world. It can also mean about how do you affect the people around you? How do you affect your friends? What positive impact do you have with colleagues at work? While it may not be as grand as standing up for civil rights or anything, if you can affect those around you in a positive way, whether it be loving, caring, making them laugh, that seemed to be, for me, what Ted does. Because all the people who get to know Ted, you know, they respect Ted. They love Ted. You know, and Ted, too, is a caring bear, let's say. He cares about his friends and his loved ones. So that's what he contributed to me. Like, not, you don't have to necessarily be this big, you know, sometimes everything starts with the small stuff. And with Ted, and it was sort of weird that Morgan Freeman's character said, what have you done with your life, Ted? And it's like, yeah, okay, so he smokes pot. He can be, you know, pretty off color. I get that. But you know what? The people around him, he doesn't hurt anybody. And the people around him really love him and respect him. And he has a great relationship with the Flash, with Flash Gordon, for crying out loud. So he obviously has affected the people within his circle in a very positive way. And he has sentience. He has conscious thought. And to me, that's what this story is about. It's one of the great Star Trek Next Generation episodes of proving whether or not Data is sentient, whether he is human or not, or Pinocchio, for that matter, and learning about what it is to be a person. And I think at the end, you know, it all comes together. It's a big happy ending. I think there is a little bit of an arc for Ted to realize that, you know, he has affected people in a positive way and that he can continue to contribute to at least his small circle of friends. And now, because it got so much media attention, maybe to society, but I think the running theme was that civil rights is still an issue today. And I don't want to get too deep into this, but I think this was part what Seth MacFarlane was saying. We still have these civil liberty issues going on. I mean, the mere fact that gay marriage was just approved by the Supreme Court, that it took so long, and there are still people who are arguing and fighting this in Texas. In Texas, they are not going to adhere to the Supreme Court. So we still have these issues going on today. Issues of racism happening. So, you know, can a comedy show off that stuff? It can. And I think in a microcosm, Ted 2 does that.
I think it's just part of a good satire is you have to have a very succinct message. You know, Dr. Strangelove, very succinct, right? And so I feel like that message, if there was a message, it just got lost in all the rest of the clutter. Mm-hmm. Unfortunate.
Yeah.
One of the things, so I want to, you know, there's a lot of great kind of set stuff and trivia that you have that I have. One of the things that would have, there's a lot of cameos, and we'll talk about all of them.
Yeah.
But there's one in particular that it would have added even to the length more. Stephen Collins had a major cameo.
Yes.
And after the child sex abuse video confession, he was cut.
Yeah.
I don't know what the scene was. I don't have context.
No, I had read the same thing.
That one was, that's actually something that was left on the floor.
That was left on the floor. Yep. And surprisingly, too, because Seth MacFarlane said, like, how is it? Like, what do you leave? Like, do you feel like you're shoehorning in too much? Do you have to take out? And he's like, no, we're pretty much everything that we don't shoehorn in. The way he works, at least what he says was, everything's up on screen. you know, and I try to use it, you know, I can second guess myself. He goes, but yeah, I try to put as much in and leave little out. And I don't, he doesn't consider it shoehorning in, so to speak. So yeah, that, and that's why I think in this one, there's a lot of stuff in there. Yeah. But I, to me, it didn't feel shoehorned in. Again, I just went along with it. I thought it was hysterical, most of it.
But here's the, you know, part of, this is just in general a note to any filmmakers. And it doesn't matter whether it's a drama, comedy, horror film, doesn't matter, right?
Right.
It's just a simple exercise that you should do regardless, right?
Right.
A movie, when you make a movie, right, no matter how it's filmed and so on, like, you know, and especially, I don't care how, you know, even if you're Christopher Nolan, you still have to try various things out. And one of the reasons why Christopher Nolan is so secret about this stuff, because he wants the ability to play with some of the stuff and not be reprimanded for it in any sort of way, however, you know, even just from the public's eye of whatever. But so when you're editing a movie, take stuff out, move stuff around, and especially with comedy, you don't know if something's funny without something until you take it out. Keep taking out more and more things to see if you really, you might figure out you didn't really need it. And it might be funnier without it. But you, and you know what? Sometimes the case is that it might not be.
Right.
But you don't know until you try.
You know, and it's funny that you say that, because I had pulled up an interview with Seth MacFarlane, and he referenced where he had a conversation with Norman Lear. For those of you who don't know, Norman Lear, one of the biggest honchos and writers of TV, and talk about social political satire in TV, Norman Lear was responsible for All in the Family, Maude, The Jeffersons, you know, some on-point, very off color for the time, and very controversial, so to speak. But he knew comedy to a point, and he's like, he had this conversation with Norman Lear about, does it ever get to a point where you can predict this and find the equation for what is funny, basically, so that you know beforehand what joke is going to work and what doesn't. And Norman Lear's response was, absolutely not. You're guessing all the time. All you can really do is gauge what you think is funny. If you throw it up in front of enough audiences and they laugh, well, you've hit the mark. If you don't, you gotta cut it. So, you know, MacFarlane goes through the test screening process as well. And, you know, I can, for anybody outside of Seth MacFarlane, even Matt Stone, Trey Parker, for South Park, you got to figure out, like, it's tough to guess what an audience on any particular day, what they're going to laugh at and what they're not going to laugh at. You know, you could release Ted and everybody can find it funny. A Million Ways to Die in the West, a lot of people didn't find it funny. You know, we're one of the two. Or two of the two. Right here. We're two of the two right here. And, you know, so I think comedy is very tough to do, and to do it well, and to do it consistently. So, yeah, it unfortunately for these people, it is sort of kind of a guessing thing. And to your point, yeah, take it out if they or put it in. If they laugh, you keep it. It's got to be a tough editing process. For that, what am I going to keep in and keep out? Who am I going to cut out?
Yeah.
So, yeah. As it stands, you know, I think it's busy work.
It is. Well, it's busy work has a negative connotation. It's necessary, you know, and part of it is, I get it. This was a staple movie. Universal wanted the, as I said, they wanted this thing fast-tracked. So, absolutely. You're not... You can have all the, as much technology as we have in the world, whether CGI, you know, editing and this and that. The thing that you can't replace is just, you need time with the movie, you know? And if you don't have that, like, okay, yeah. So in realistically, you can edit a movie and have it done. And let's say, you know, do all the CGI in a month and a half, 2 months and have it scored and this and that. Is it going to be good? You need the time with the movie, and part of that, that's why, you know, maybe it's Universal giving him that pressure, because I guarantee you they were.
Yeah, I mean,
for this movie,
and plus for him too, after coming off A Million Ways to Die in the West, which, you know, had to have been to some extent, and I don't know the man personally, and he's never talked to me about this, but I have to think, in some extent, it was a little bit disheartening. because, you know, Ted came out, got critical acclaim, got box office, and A Million Ways to Die.
That was his first. And that was his
first, yeah, first thing out of the bat. And his, you know, he's going to be hosting the Academy Awards. And Family Guy is really huge. And so you're riding a wave. And when a movie like A Million Ways to Die in the West comes out, and that really slams on the brakes, you know, I can only assume that there may have been a little bit of self-introspection. What could I have done differently? You know, I had a great time. I thought I was making, you know, the best movie I thought. You know, so obviously when Ted 2 comes around, Universal's like looking, okay, you got to do the sequel, you know, and we have to bury A Million Ways to Die in the West. So you're on, kid, but we're going to be watching you. We're not going to give you a ton of money.
Well, they give more. They give more. The first one, what, it was around $50 million.
And this one was...
I think it was like closer to 85.
And I don't know how much A Million Ways to Die in the West
cost.
We can look that up. But, you know, I'm sure they were looking at him a little bit more. I think he was probably a little bit more under the microscope on this one.
I think so, too. And, you know, by the way, Maria Menounos, who's obviously helped start Popcorn Talk for us and continues to support us. You know, as our the face of Popcorn Talk, she actually knows Seth MacFarlane really well, and you know, they do a lot of interviews on E and stuff like that. And she attended the premieres and various things. And as I said, her and Seth are very good friends. Check out some of those interviews. They don't go too deep, like the Howard Stern interview. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's a shame just because it's the news format of that.
Sure.
It's literally 15-30 seconds at most.
Right.
But one day, you know, for his next movie, I would love to get, you know, time permitting. And again, you want to talk about Maria's equally as busy in the two of them.
Absolutely.
You know, but I would love to get them one day and just talk about these various things.
Yeah.
And go even deeper than Howard Stern. Because Howard does a great interview, but.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think Seth has a lot to say.
Yeah.
With everything that he does. And I think he puts that in his movies and I think he puts it in his television show. You know, I want to go back on cameos because there was one cameo in this movie that I did not expect to see at all. In fact, I thought the joke was just a throwaway line, and then it followed up with the cameo. And this is the Jay Leno one. When that happened, like the joke itself, the one throwaway line I found funny. Which was something to the effect of, help me out here. It's like,
yeah, he was trying to play, hey, if you do that,
this took place in the bar.
Yeah, I'll tell him about how Jay Leno is in the bathroom sucking cock.
Yeah. And you go, okay, oh, that's really funny because you wouldn't picture that. And then all of a sudden, who comes out of the men's room? It's Jay Leno going, he said something like,
oh, sorry, didn't realize it was, yeah.
Sorry, yeah. He goes, oh, did you hear that in there? I don't know what's going on. And to see Jay Leno in that, like, look, I'm not a major fan of Jay Leno, but the mere fact that they got him to do that, you know, this is the guy that America loved, middle America, but you don't expect him to be this blue. And I thought that like, it was such a shock to me. It was really the cherry on the sundae for that joke. I thought it was hysterical.
Yeah, and We'll kind of go through the various ones,
sure.
but Tom Brady obviously was kind of the heavily politicized one, and I really give
publicized.
Absolutely. People knew that was coming up, and the sort of context
it was in the
of
trailer
that.
And yep.
Where I give them a lot of credit is they kept it very current. So I don't know if they just kept having to reshoot, and Tom was just great about it.
ADR. Mm-hmm. They ADR'd the Deflategate joke because that had happened. The movie was already in the can. Yeah. Don't worry, we love your balls. It's just a great joke. And, you know, he was even asked. He goes, did that fly with Tom Brady? He goes, well, we didn't really ask him. But, yeah, you know, I mean, Tom Brady had a sense of humor. And, again, one thing that we can talk about Seth MacFarlane, I think, is polarizing. Some people love Seth MacFarlane, but he has a lot of haters out there. Tom Brady's the same way. I think there's a little corner in the United States map that loves Tom Brady and a whole lot of other people who just hate him.
Yeah.
So I think that having him in the movie personally as a New England from Boston and as a New England Patriots fan, I thought it to be hysterical. The mere fact that he would do that, the whole Pulp Fiction reference with lifting up the covers, it was like that gold wash, and I thought that was great. And the Deflategate joke was great. And, when he throws Ted out the window, like, he doesn't wake up going, oh, he goes, wow, that was a perfect spiral. Like, it was a great joke, great gag.
Yeah, and I thought it was brilliant, you know, that just even to go to the next level of knowing that there's a code for people trying to steal.
The 317.
Yeah.
The 317.
Yep. For people trying to steal Tom Brady's jizz.
And it's funny, too, because, again, another Boston reference, one of the cops is Lenny Clark, who is a popular Boston comedian. And he's the guy that says, yeah, it's a 317. Yeah, up, somebody's trying to steal Tom Brady's jizz again. And they drive off. So, you know, Lenny Clark, Boston comedian, you know, he has 2 seconds in the movie. I was like, oh, I knew who he was. So yeah, there were a lot of New England references going in there.
Yeah.
Including a lobster in the, I called it the Three Amigos scene when they were sitting around in the campfire and all the little animals were coming up and he kept on cutting and there was one that was a lobster. I thought that was hysterical. That was great.
People really loved Liam Neeson in this movie. And I thought it was great. It just, as a singular scene, it was great. I as I was watching it, I was laughing, but I also questioned how many people actually know about Tricks.
I was hoping you were going to bring that up because we had that conversation. So I'm going to throw it out to the audience. I mean, Tricks are for
kids.
I mean, yeah, the Tricks are for kids. But
Silly Rabbit. Tricks
silly
are for
right. It did people catch that reference? I mean, I caught it. I used to eat Tricks as a kid because they told me I could. And adults weren't supposed to eat Tricks. But, it wasn't until you had mentioned that I didn't even think that people wouldn't get that reference. I was like, oh, that's hysterical.
Yeah.
I thought it was great.
I mean, part of the hilarity is that it's just Liam Neeson.
Right.
You know, and obviously it's because of their collaboration with A Million Ways to Die in the West. Some trivia sites are like, oh, this is Liam Neeson and Morgan Freeman's fourth collaboration together. First, they haven't really been in a scene. Even in Christopher Nolan's Dark Knight series.
Right.
They weren't really in scenes together. No. But anyway, I thought that was funny.
And it led to, part of what I love about Seth MacFarlane is the sarcasm. Because it came to that line where towards the end of that scene, Liam Neeson slides across like a $5 bill and he goes, I'm not going to forget what you did for me today. And he goes, I'd rather you did. Yeah. I love that. I know it's silly, but it's that kind of sarcasm that I live for. Maybe it's that Bostonian stuff. I just love
you
that.
You got to go watch more stand-up comedy.
I do. You know,
I think like that'll get your fix. So that was absolutely funny. And by the way, for those of you who stayed through the credits, you will have gotten a nice treat. I won't spoil it for those of you who didn't. Shame on you.
Oh, I will. I stayed for
spoiler
the credits.
Spoiler alert!
Yeah, spoiler, that's what we're all about. I mean, I thought it was hysterical because it was a callback and Liam Neeson comes back to the grocery store all beat up, including his box of Tricks. He just puts it back on the shelf and he walks away. And I'm like, I didn't expect it to come. I don't think there was a button in the original Ted. I just stayed for the credits because I was a schmohawk and I just stayed there. I was like, oh, let me see if anything happens. There's so many references in that movie. I just had a feeling that maybe they'd throw one more in for just for shits and giggles, so to speak.
Speaking of, we talked a little bit about how A Million Ways to Die in the West. Amanda Seyfried was also in that movie. And I feel like that's why she ended up in this one.
Yeah, you know.
Which is great.
I thought she was great. And she, again,
I give her credit because the whole Gollum thing.
That was great.
It was so true.
Uh-huh.
And the fact that she's okay with that and just being like, okay, fine. I get it. I may, like.
Right.
Kudos
the fact that she didn't get, like, I love that she didn't get the pop culture references that they were talking about. Like, that was funny to me. So the fuck me eyes, no, you have more like the give me my precious Gollum eyes. What's that?
By the way, fuck me eyes was that's Lexi Atkins, who's been at Popcorn Talk multiple times.
Great.
So she's a friend of ours. Bill Smitrovich.
Great interview, Harry. He was so, it was like, hey, we had him on the show.
Yeah, he was, check out that interview from November Man.
Yep. And so, he fired Ted. He was Ted's boss.
Yeah. He had to, because Ted was a property.
He was property.
So I thought that was great. I thought Amanda Seyfried, she just did, she did really, really well with, just going along with it.
Yeah, and Seth said that he really loved working with her on A Million Ways to Die in the West. And he really, he was looking forward to having her in Ted 2 and working together again. And again, I think what Seth does, and part of the reason why I enjoy his movies and such, and again, I sort of kind of throw it back to like Mel Brooks. I mean, Judd Apatow does this a lot as well as Paul Feig. You know, when you work with a bunch of people, like he tends to, his sets, albeit I've not been on one, they seem to have like this family type of atmosphere. And, you know, bringing all these people on, whether it's Amanda Seyfried, Liam Neeson, Mark Wahlberg, Giovanni Ribisi, you know, getting these people back on, it's like, oh, I would love to work with you. And everybody that you hear, like from Charlize Theron to Amanda Seyfried to Mark Wahlberg to Giovanni Ribisi, they love working on these movies with him. And you can sort of kind of tell. And even when you go back to Mel Brooks,
I think he did the same thing. He also played, there's a Amanda Seyfried, right? There's a fun article that came out about five things you didn't know about her, and just a couple of them. She calls herself controlling, loyal, and eccentric, and she just hates bad grammar so much so that she corrects people's bad texts. And so knowing that about her, I think he utilized just her personalities in general in real life towards her character. So that way, you know, she was very stiff of like, you guys don't know F. Scott Fitzgerald. Why the fuck would his name be Fuck Scott Fitzgerald? Why'd you call him?
Again, that was hysterical to me. And again, it's such a simple joke. When you think about it, you go, how come nobody else has thought of that? Like, why did it take this long? Because it's when you F. Scott Fitzgerald. Oh, yeah. It's a great joke. It's a great joke. And she was really, and I agree with you. But I think it's one of those things that when you're working together with people, it appears as if it makes the process that much easier. And when you're making a comedy with people that get it, to me, it just seems more naturalistic. There's nothing worse than a forced comedy.
Yeah.
Would you agree? You know, oh, well, number one, there's nothing worse than a comedy that's not funny. But when it's a forced comedy and your actors and actresses maybe just don't belong, I don't get that in Seth MacFarlane movies. Yeah. They all seem to get it and have a good time.
Absolutely. We'll talk about more kind of stuff. But real fast, I do want to say this year, right, on July... Well, last year, July 15th, MacFarlane was served with a lawsuit from the production company of a series of internet videos called Acting School Academy and Charlie the Abusive Teddy Bear, claiming that Ted violates the copyright of its videos due to the character Ted largely matching the background story, persona, voice, attitude, and dialogue of the character Charlie. And the reason I bring this up because, in 2015, March, it was settled out of court with undisclosed terms. So we get Ted 2.
Of course it was.
I hate those kind of stories just in general. I mean, even if it was like first
money, yeah.
You know, I guarantee you, like, two completely different things. Like, if you, a log line, yes, a log line can be copied multiple times.
Sure.
Doesn't mean if you and I, like, literally write, let's say, two men go on an adventure, and whatever, discover dinosaurs. your movie if you write one, right. and my movie, the two completely different things. Unless we're literally that, like, synced up.
And you're talking about Hollywood, which, you know, we could talk about, like, in 1 year had two volcano movies, but one didn't sue the other. And then, you know, it's crazy. And it always, whenever you hear those stories and you ever hear, yeah, I was settled out of court for an undisclosed amount, it means that somebody got paid a lot of money just to shut up and say, yeah. hey, you know, and the mere fact that they had to go through that lawsuit to happen, you know, it's just a shame, but
yeah,
you know, as John Hammond said, the money sucking lawyers. So, but you know, the other thing too, I don't know when we're going to, you know, we were talking about the cameos.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I brought up top, and I didn't know if you want to talk about references next or where you wanted to go next.
Well, I want to talk about references, but most of the references that I have and that probably you have are from the Comic Con convention.
Right.
But I want you to talk about how that came to be. Because you were kind of fascinated by the process.
Yeah, they you know, it was organically written into the script that there was going to be a Comic-Con thing. Again, we had the Amanda Seyfried character. We should probably get what her name is.
Her name is Samantha.
It's Samantha.
Samantha Leslie Jackson.
So Sam L. Jackson. So Sam L. Jackson, who is a pop, who knows nothing of pop culture, throwing in the Comic-Con reference and then starting it off with seeing the Star Wars characters crossing the street. And then she makes the big faux pas of going, oh, there's the Star
Trek.
Captain
Kirk.
Star Trek characters. But then to take it the step further, having Ted go, these people shouldn't even, don't you know that he's your dad and that you're supposed to be his boss? And, like, you, Ted geek-tastically breaks it down as to these three people shouldn't even be walking together. So they wanted to film in San Diego, even though it was a New York Comic Con. So to my knowledge, some scenes were filmed in San Diego. It looked like the San Diego. I mean, I've been to San Diego Comic Con for some years now. So those glass ceilings, you know, are very familiar to me. However, scenes that took place in Comic-Con, and this is great movie magic, because I actually felt that they were filming in New York Comic-Con too. Mm. The scenes that they filmed were actually done on a very, very large soundstage. All of it. And they reached out to Comic-Con vendors and they said, hey, we're making a movie. What can you give us? And they said they got so much shit. Like, it was insane, the outpouring of love.
Shit, meaning the good kind, hey, what the hell?
Exactly. They got, like, they came up and set up booths as if it were a Comic-Con. And I can tell you from the only thing that was different was Comic-Con is, like, 100 times more crowded. There is no way that you're able to run around that, you know, that nimbly with so much space. But other than that, it looked like Comic-Con. To find out that they filmed all that in a soundstage, well, number one, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Because there's so much you have to control, including an Enterprise D that's going to take out one of your main characters.
The Rocket. The Rocket hit John.
That was the Starship Enterprise. And again, I love that stuff. But again, they made it look like Comic-Con. And it was brilliant. And a lot of the references I found to be, there were, like, in that one 10, 15 minutes.
Well, let's talk about that, because you had Peter Griffin fighting the chicken.
Okay, so if we're going to talk, you know, I mean, number one, well, I'm going to go from, like, small to large, and I'm going to get to Comic-Con. But number one, the love of John Hughes. You know, obviously, Seth MacFarlane was affected by John Hughes. There were two fantastic references, two of which came from The Breakfast Club. The dancing scene in the cafeteria, it was great. And then the other one was the scene from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, the famous thing where Steve Martin is asleep in the car and John Candy is driving around to the runaround. He's driving the car and he's singing the song and he's smoking his cigarette. And I heard runaround and driving and I'm like going, oh my God. This is exactly from Planes, Trains, and Automobiles. I go, if Ted does the little piano thing on the dashboard, I go, I am going to lose it. His arms couldn't reach the dashboard, I guess, so he did it on the steering wheel, and then he even proceeded to lose his cigarette onto his lap, which burned, which caused them to crash as it did. I thought that was a great scene. So there was the love of John Hughes right there. Then, you know, there was a love of Jurassic Park, the original. You know, when they see the pot.
Which is a great reference. I mean, by the way, Universal must love this right around this time.
Of course, the Jurassic World.
Yeah, so it just brings back more nostalgia for that.
It was a great reference because, you know, he just, the homage of the shot going in and Ted turning Amanda Seyfried's, you know, Sam's head around like it was in the original Jurassic Park. And they're all in awe of a pot field, you know, which is hysterical. But the kicker to me is he capped the joke off with, they do travel in herds. They do travel in herds, which is what the Alan Grant character says in Jurassic Park. And does pot travel in herds? No, but the
apparently
line is great.
It does.
So then you have that. And all right, now we get into like Comic-Con. So a big fight ensues. And audience, please help us out. This is what I caught. First and foremost, there was a Kirk versus Picard fight.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Kirk does his running jump kick into Picard. That was hysterical. Then you had Robbie the Robot from Forbidden Planet, okay? Now, or it was a Dalek from Doctor Who. I tend to forget which one. My sources that I've read say it was a Dalek versus B9, which is the robot from the television series Lost in Space. That was hysterical. Then you had, well, obviously, Peter Griffin was fighting a chicken, mm-hmm. which is a which common is theme in the in Family Guy. But then you had the Gorn from Star Trek, the lizard creature in Star Trek, fighting the creature from the Black Lagoon. I mean, I was crying. That was hysterical. Then you got to see Godzilla. Then you got to see Lilo from The Fifth Element. I mean, he threw in Lilo from The Fifth Element doing backflips like she did in The Fifth Element. Then you had an Orion slave girl getting into a fight with somebody from anime. Please forgive me. I'm not too much knowledgeable about anime. And then you had the Enterprise D. The Enterprise, like a scale thing of the Enterprise D takes out John. So those were some of the references that I was able to catch. Knight Rider was in there somewhere.
Knight Rider, well, that was the cell phone theme.
The cell phone theme, okay.
You had the Ninja Turtles
there. The Ninja Turtles, of course. I'm trying to think. The other fantastic reference was, okay, so at the beginning of the movie, at Ted's wedding, you bring out Patrick Warburton and Michael Dorn. And I looked, I Putty from Seinfeld, you know exactly who this guy is. When Michael Dorn came on screen, it took me a couple of seconds to realize that, oh my God, that's Worf from Star Trek The Next Generation. I said, good for him for getting work. That's great. And they play gay lovers. And then they come back later on in the movie and they, first off, Patrick Warburton was in a Tick costume, which he starred as the Tick in a television series, short-lived television series. And Michael Dorn came out wearing a Star Trek Next Generation Lieutenant Worf costume. And I thought that that was and not a very good costume. Like, his makeup wasn't that great, but I just thought that was hysterical that those guys would do that. And again, I really do think that they do it for the love of McFarlane. Like, you know, it's like, why would you put yourself in Comic-Con and do this? It's you know, I'm sure they got paid, but they get the joke. Just like Seth MacFarlane says, I get the joke. That's why you get Jay Leno coming out of a bathroom. And I think there's an admiration for him. Said, yeah, I'll do this. Why not? And that, to me, was a great, great reference and throwaway that I just loved. So I know that I'm missing a lot. Is there anybody live who's like bringing anything up? Is there anybody listening to us live today? Great.
Well, if they
always are, curious.
I mean, it's the 4th of July, but hey, if you missed us today, don't forget we're on demand.
Was there anything that I missed? What did you see?
At the Comic-Con, you pretty much covered everything that I know of. There's when Tammy Lynn says or that she spent $129 at Filene's basement. It's been out of business for a couple of years, so yep. That's where you went wrong. That's where okay. You went wrong.
But that was when she said Filene's basement. That again, only a New Englander would get that. Like, really. I mean, who from Missouri or who from...
But either way, you know that it's like... You know that it's like some department. It doesn't, like, that one doesn't quite, yes, you can go that next layer, but the joke is funny enough because it's like, what woman doesn't spend a time? And then she's like, I need it for work. Well, you're a cashier. What do you need it for work for?
Right.
And then she's got all the jewelry. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just not on par.
Yeah, there was a Kardashian joke. There was a Bill Cosby joke.
So many Kardashian jokes. Paddington the bear.
When
Ted has his whole his raincoat his, outfit yep, just to protect him from, he's like, "Why are you wearing that? I'm not getting jizz on me." which is good because he's a teddy bear and it would stain. One of the other things that I Kramer versus Kramer, like, their
oh
whole,
Kramer versus Kramer, that was a great one too.
Everyone kind of the whole. I forget what Ted ultimately brought up, but, you know, we start with the books where, you know, where Sam L. Jackson brings the actual books.
Right.
Mark Wahlberg brings in all the various things.
The cases.
And then Ted just, he derails all of it with right. his movies. Which I thought, speaking of movies, they did something very clever early on that didn't quite pan out later, where they made fun of Law and Order, which I thought...
Yes.
Would come back in some sort of way because there was a lot of legal, you know, courtroom stuff in the entire movie, and I thought their scene with like overruled,
sustained, sidebar, yeah. We could be lawyers.
I thought that was great, and I thought,
and then they put lyrics to the Law and Order theme song.
Yeah, and then, so that's what I'm talking. I thought just their love of Law and Order would actually come back in some sort of way.
And I believe them when they were getting rid of the evidence, so to speak, and they were in, like, Boston Harbor. Mm-hmm. Like, that was supposed to be a throwback to Law and Order some way that you know, mm-hmm. they're diving down to hide the evidence, so to speak.
Yeah, yeah. Let's see what else is... When John spills the vials of sperm on himself, it's similar to a Family Guy episode called Sibling Rivalry. So you had that. Obviously we talked about the Jurassic Park theme. This is a kind of a reference. One of the depressing suggestions made at the improv comedy show, was 9/11. And interestingly enough, both Mark Wahlberg and Seth MacFarlane were booked for those flights. But Mark Wahlberg changed his flight last minute and MacFarlane arrived too late to make the flight. One of the reasons I think that's an interesting note, but one of the reasons I want to point that out is, as much, you know, we mentioned Kardashians right. kind of being made fun of, and they're an easy target regardless right. for most people.
Yeah.
I mean, you hear 10 jokes every single day about the Kardashians. However, I like this because they're not afraid to make fun of themselves for what, I mean, it's a pretty deep, dark joke if you really think about it, but they're not yes. afraid to go there to get that laugh at no. the expense of them, you know.
Yeah, and again,
and you could say like, yeah, it's easy for them to make that joke because they weren't actually on the flight. But if you know anyone in touch with their self in any sort of way, that right. you got to be like, holy crap, I'm lucky to not be right. you know, have been on that flight. Like, I really feel for everything that happened, but holy crap, I am lucky as shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so, you know, I can respect that, you know, when you come that close to your own mortality and to be able to make fun, then I could say, okay, great. They had everything was on the table. They weren't right. limited or just going after certain things.
Sure.
Everything and anything was on the table. So I respect that.
Yeah, and again, it's one of the things that I respect about Seth MacFarlane and politically correctness or incorrectness today. One more thing, too, about... I want to talk about political correctness in this day and age. But before that, there was another...
Make sure you're politically correct. Cause...
I'll do my best. But, okay, so we talked about the Breakfast Club scene where they're dancing like they were in the cafeteria. So while the song in the background apparently is from Revenge of the Nerds, which is funny. Now that I didn't pick out. So, you know, do we want to talk about political correctness?
Well, in what way?
I mean,
yeah, first off, the one you can't get, white nigga.
Right.
What is a white nigga?
What is that?
I've
is
only
that
heard them as referenced as crackers.
Honky. <Yeah. laughs> So, that scene was very funny. I thought it was very funny. And Ted's like, so you're just going to keep on saying it? Wait, is that even acceptable today? Is that like...
When was it acceptable? Exactly. What is a white nigga?
I don't know.
I get it. It's a white
Vanilla
curse.
Ice, maybe? Someone who... I don't know.
No, but in the context of that, it was a family. It was like the stereotypical white picket fence family. You had the husband, the wife, and the kid, and they're right. Like shopping for the kid. Like that's not like Vanilla Ice. He's a rapper,
right?
That no, they're not white. Like if a white nigga is someone hip,
and it was
weren't.
A black woman saying it, a cashier who kept on saying it, and you can see the discomfort that Ted was having. I found that scene again to be funny, but when we talk about political correctness today, again, this was something that you know, like a movie like A Blazing Saddles probably couldn't get off the ground today due to oversensitive and overheightened political correctness. People tend to claim that they're offended by so many things, and sometimes I think they do it just to say that they're offended when they might not actually just get the joke. And this is one of the reasons why, you know, comedy should be allowed to be that way. And there are many comedians who worked very differently. Like, some will be very blue, some will be like Jerry Seinfeld. Now, Jerry Seinfeld is not a controversial stand-up comic. Would you agree?
You believe it or not, I'm not as in tune with his humor, so I'm not gonna... But what I will say, for me, you know, I don't have a... If the joke's funny, it's funny,
right?
First and foremost. So if the you can go as wrong, if you go to the far end of the spectrum to be so unpolitically correct or incorrect, but the joke's not funny, I don't care,
right?
If you make it funny, great. And I think furthermore, maybe I've shared this on another show, but the difference for me is Ted 2 isn't quite a satire, but a good satire, you know. But even a joke of political incorrectness.
Right.
Why are you getting upset? Really think about that. What is it about that joke that is actually making you upset? And think about it. And yes, if you are truly deeply upset, then what are you actually, you know, then obviously it's resonating because it holds true in today's society. And what are you actually doing about it to change it? And if the answer is nothing, then you can't really be mad at anyone but yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
maybe not support that
sometimes I do even think it's deeper. It's you're upset because it rings true, not because you're not doing anything about it, because it's you.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you know what, that sucks. Guess what, 100%, but be willing to admit that.
Yeah, and I agree. And sometimes comedy in that sense, it really makes people look at things in a different light or through somebody else's eyes, or puts the spotlight on something that is considered to be controversial and whatnot. And, you know, I mean, even just recently, the only reason why I brought up Jerry Seinfeld is he is one of the he's a safe comic. He definitely is not blue. He's an observational comedian. And he just recently said, I'm not going to play at colleges because there's too much political correctness. Like, I can't, you know, I don't feel comfortable doing it. And he got a lot of backlash for saying that. And it's weird. I think comedians today are so put under the microscope that very few, like Louis C.K., has broken through, and he's become very popular as that great show on FX. But some people are held under such a microscope for what is being said.
Do you think Energized Clay could well, do anything today. I mean, he used to call them fags on stage.
Absolutely. Andrew Dice Clay, Sam Kinison. Look at George Carlin's humor back in the day. I mean, there were some Lenny. There was a great Dustin Hoffman played him. I can't think of his last name. I want to say Clark. Mm-hmm. But, you know, comedians are always being stifled. And when you have a Seth MacFarlane that's able to put out a TED 2, which is as ribald and it's raunchy, but it can be considered very off color from language that it uses to what it's attacking as far as civil liberties and things like that. Mel Brooks used to do this. And, you know, Mel Brooks had a great story when he was making Blazing Saddles. He was sitting with an executive. I believe Warner Brothers released it. He's sitting with an executive who was looking over the script, and the executive said, he had a red pen, and he's like, okay, you got to take this joke out, this joke out, this joke out. And he was just marking up his script like being in a school classroom. And Mel Brooks was just sitting there going, And then they finished up with their meeting. The executive walked out of the room, and Mel Brooks took the script and threw it in the trash with all the markings, and he went off and he made the movie that he, Richard Pryor, and a bunch of other writers wrote and made. So even back in the 70s, people like Mel Brooks were having a hard time making movies like Blazing Saddles, which I'm not entirely sure could be made today. And I think a movie like Ted and Ted 2, into an effect, some of the Judd Apatow movies, like, they will touch upon subjects that I think, you know, they should be. It's comedy. It's comedy. And I thank Seth MacFarlane for putting that stuff out there because, you know, I laugh. If you're offended by this stuff, you're not going to go see a rated R comedy about a talking teddy bear.
I think it's just, honestly, it just speaks to deeper issues. Whatever, you can get all philosophical, right? And I don't know. One of the ways I've heard life summarized is there's three rules: paradox, humor, and change. And in terms of humor, you got to have a sense of humor, especially about yourself. And if you can't, right, you're doomed.
Yes, and who do we blame for a lot of this, though? Seth MacFarlane, in an interview, you know, he thinks that there's been a little bit of mischaracterization, the way the wind is blowing. He goes, I don't think it's something that's coming directly from the public. I think if you asked an average person, were you offended by this joke in this comedy? I'm trying to think if I've ever been offended by something. And he says, I think a lot of the press blow things up to, you know, he believes that the press makes things bigger than they probably should be. And, you know, he goes, I don't think it's coming from the public at large. I think there's a maelstrom that's being stirred up by the press who, in many cases, are screaming at people to be offended at things where otherwise they would just be taken as jokes. And I don't disagree with that comment. I see where he's going. And sometimes we are told by media, that's just not right. Yeah. I mean, somebody like Howard Stern has been persecuted throughout his entire career by the media, by people telling you, that's just not right. You know, when people, I think, can form their own opinion, and you know, we do have a say in this society as to whether or not I don't have to give my $12 to go see Ted 2, because that's not what I like. So you just don't go see it. But, you know, with everything that's gone on politically with civil rights, it's tough. It's tough. You say the wrong thing today, and your career could be over. You could be fired. You can lose a job.
Look at what happened with Miss USA.
Right.
Talk about recent events. Look that one up, mm-hmm, if you're watching this 10 years down the line.
Yeah. I mean, so it can be tough to put this in a movie or in a television show. And that's why Trey Parker and Matt Stone have been able to. They've done it to aplomb, and they do a great job. I mean, South Park, bigger, badder. The South Park movie was fantastic.
Team America.
Yeah, it's just great
Team
stuff.
Team America. Fuck yeah.
Fuck yeah.
By the way, speaking of 4th of July weekend, absolutely, go see that movie. Woo!
Yeah, so, you know, I'm very thankful that, you know, Seth MacFarlane is able to put together a movie like this. And you can look at it from a social perspective, or you can just look at it to make you laugh. And that's the first and foremost in a comedy. Comedy's got to make me laugh. If I can get something out of it extra, you know, I mean, I love Airplane. which I think celebrates its 30th anniversary today. That movie makes me laugh. Doesn't make, you know, there's no social political agenda in Airplane. It's just this great slapstick comedy. So, you know.
So let's talk about, because I don't want us to be a 2-hour podcast.
Sure.
Not a 2-hour comedy. Yeah. Let's talk about, unfortunately, where it's at money wise.
Well, you know.
Where it's I would say it's okay. It's not great. I mean, Universal, at least what they're saying to the public is that they're not worried about it. I mean, they have Jurassic World out. Jurassic World sure. continues to be number one.
Right.
And they're like, well, it's because of Jurassic World holding on to that number one spot that Ted 2, you know, came in third under Inside Out. So whether or not that's true and that could be fine.
Look, I think that Jurassic World, took...
It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah, and it took the industry by surprise that it did so well, which, shame on you, industry. I mean, come on. Like, you should know better. I mean, their tools are not working. But in any case, but to an extent, I do believe that because, you know, number one, the total budget with hard drives and advertising is around $125 million. It opened up number three domestically at the box office on June 26th of this year. Its opening weekend gross was $33.5 million. To date, its total gross is around 47. You know, its worldwide box office, the worldwide is like, it's about 65, give or take. But here's the thing. On Rotten Tomatoes, it got a 46% rating. Its cinema score was a B+, which isn't horrible. It's not an A. Everybody looks for an A, but who doesn't, whether you're a student
Ted, the original, got an A-.
Yes.
So you're not that far off.
You're not that far off. And just to give you an example, though, too, we were talking about the original Ted. I have, I did a comparison. I did a side-by-side. You know, we're looking at the opening weekend for Ted was 54. Ted 2 was 33 million. Now, again, I'm going to bring up Jurassic World and Inside Out. One way to, if I can simplify this, to try to look at box office, especially for an opening weekend, is you got to try to figure out spending the money. Okay, and so an easy way that was taught to me or that I learned was you look at it as a piece of pie, okay? And so much money is going to this slice of movie right here. So in this case, it would be Jurassic World. So much more money is going to this other slice, which is Inside Out, right? And then you have Ted 2. Then you got to look at the other movies that are still in the marketplace, and you got to try to figure out, like, there's only so much box office that can come in, like, of people going to the movies today, that if they're spending a majority of their money on Jurassic World and then Inside Out, and then comes this rated R comedy, you got to figure out how much more money is there out there when 70% of your box office is coming from two movies. Yeah. You know, it's not leaving a big slice of the pie for what is out there, for the rest of what is out there. And you have competition. And again, nobody predicted that Jurassic World was going to have such staying power. And then you have a Pixar movie that's doing fantastically well. And you're hitting...
No surprise there.
Yeah, there's no surprise. And you're looking at movies. Those two movies alone are what they would call a four-quadrant movie, which means they're crossing all borders. Everybody's going to see those movies, where Ted 2 is rated R. And, you know, you are not necessarily a four quadrant movie because you're not getting the kids in. When Ted came out, it did not have the competition that Ted 2 had. So regardless of reception, you know, there's so much box office dollars there. And when you had two juggernauts to go up against and then a rated R comedy, it's not too surprising. You know, I don't know if we'll get a Ted 3 because of it, but we'll see how it plays out in the 4th of July weekend as well. Mm-hmm. You know, we have a long weekend, but again, they're coming out with competition. We got Terminator Genesis.
And Magic Mike.
Woo! Double XL.
Every girl's going to see that.
We got that. We still have Jurassic World out there, and we still have Inside Out, which is like, you know, Inside Out is gaining momentum. So, oh, by the way, can I do a shameless plug for Popcorn Talk Anatomy of the Movie?
Go ahead.
Okay, folks, if you watch Inside Out, our podcast on it, which we broke that movie down very nicely, I have to say. We had a great time doing it. One of the things that was discussed in that podcast that we did over a week ago was the fact that why shouldn't Inside Out take one of the 10 slots for Best Picture? Well, since our podcast, folks, I am happy to say that there have been at least two articles. One of them, I believe, was in Variety of the Hollywood Reporter, an industry trade, you know, much revered publication, and then Deadline Hollywood, each had articles saying that, as of right now, Inside Out should fall into the Best Picture category, not animated Best Picture. I say that it was because of Anatomy of a Movie that we started this. We started this roll, this wave. That's what I'm putting it right out there.
Fair enough. Because well, go see A Million Ways to Die in the West as well if you haven't already. All right. I think that about does it for us.
I think we covered this down.
We covered a lot. If there's anything that that we haven't covered, obviously we didn't talk as much story this time around. But you know what? That's what the comment section is for. We're not here one and done. We're here one and continue.
And continue. And I think we talked, you know, this was a story of civil rights. This was a story of this is Ted, what is going to have to annul his marriage. He was going to have to, well, he lost his job because he was believed or he was deemed as being the Commonwealth of Massachusetts deemed him as property. And then it became a civil rights case. Is Ted actual property or is he an entity? Is he proper? Is he human?
Yeah.
So I really like this story and what it had to say.
Fair enough. All right. Thank you guys for joining us on another Anatomy of a Movie as we roll out with Knight Rider, which, by the way, you know what? That was most people think Baywatch was David Hasselhoff's big break that are under like 20 years old. No way.
It was Knight Rider. I'll be honest. I didn't really watch Baywatch, but Knight Rider, Kit, of course.
All right. I got to say I watched both.
There you go.
For two very different reasons.
Absolutely. I don't know whether both because of hard bodies?
No. No, definitely not. All right, guys. Thank you for joining us on Anatomy of a Movie. Have a great holiday season if you're listening to In the Moment. If you're down in the future, welcome, future people.
Welcome.
Dimitri can be found at dmovies1701. Can you guess the reference to that?
Figure that out, folks.
You can follow us here at Movie Anatomy and, of course, The Popcorn Talk on Twitter, Instagram, so on and so forth. We're on Facebook as well. Go to our website, popcorntalk.com, for all the various movie-based shows that we do. We do quite a lot of them, all very different, all perfectly wonderful.
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so we'll be doing Terminator Genesis, Magic Mike, and that's just next week. We got a great roster coming up. Ant-Man down the line.
Mission Impossible.
American Ultra. That's just the stuff I can. Batman v Superman in 2016. Oh,
absolutely.
We already got that program slate going. So, you know, continue to share, rate, and comment. And, of course, subscribe if you haven't already done so. That way you get this content right away. We'll see you next time for the next dissection.
Bye, folks.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.